This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life deep in the throes of their writing project. They'll give us insights into the creative life, tips on completing your writing project, and most important of all, a taste of their own creative efforts. Straight after that, I get a complete stranger to critique their work. The results have been surprising, and for a word nerd like me, it was pretty exciting. But I promise you, no writer was harmed in the production of this program. In this, our first episode, I've chosen a writer with whom I attended quite a few writing group sessions. He writes about being black, being gay, and all that within the context of maybe his most interesting experience, being a British migrant to Australia. Now, I say that only half-jokingly, because according to Will Roach, Australia provided him with a freedom to write. Hello, Will Roach, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Maria.
Amongst the many things that I'm looking forward to in this interview is just listening to that silken voice of yours. You've written a really beautiful volume of, would you call it a creative memoir or a memoir? What is the category you'd put your work in?
I'd call it a memoir in progress. The first one, Black, Gay and Underage, deals with my childhood years.
What I've found interesting with the writers that I've interviewed so far is that ability for a writer to just file away episodes, scenes in such detail, and they themselves, as you obviously have been, are surprised at the level of detail that you can evoke once you get into the spirit of writing. So many places I want to start with you, because you've written this memoir. You grew up in London. You've come to Australia, but you were born in
Trinidad and Tobago, one of the most beautiful places in the world.
So how old were you when you left Trinidad?
I made my first journey at 5.5 months old.
So that's when you came to
with
London?
With Mum, yeah.
You left London when you were?
Well, I've left London a number of times.
It is the kind of city one does want to leave.
10 years ago.
Okay, and you've been living in Australia for
Living in Australia ever since.
Yeah. So there are elements that deal with the issues of being black, gay, and being in these three countries. What I found interesting in listening to your story, that a lot of it was really focused, as you were saying, on being a child and looking at your father's story.
My father was a silent, dominant influence. My mother was more proactive, nurturing, if you like. And I didn't really find out about my father's story Sunday afternoons after dinner. He would bore me to death. But it wasn't anything I could really connect with. All I knew was that in some ways I was really frightened of him.
Yeah.
I didn't understand him. I admired him. I loved him, but I didn't understand him. And if there was a dispute, understanding of how the world worked, I would more listen to him from a place of resentment.
So why did you write this series of books?
It's really interesting because I never saw myself as a writer. In fact, before I came to Australia, I was vehemently opposed to the idea. But I didn't want to share my story, and I didn't think I could write.
Because you had learning issues when you were growing up.
Well, according to the education system in the UK, I did. But the reality was that I didn't. I was very, very quiet. I can remember thinking a lot and feeling a lot. I used to cry a lot. I guess I picked up on that, the tension for my parents in terms of the early years, Mum not having her own home, us sharing with relatives. And I found out later that was my dad actually helping his sister. And then as a consequence, we suffered. And I also remember in my teenage years that I never ever saw any images of myself. I never ever read, and I mean, this is something that since I've been in Australia and also elsewhere, that those who are perceive themselves as being on the outside for whatever reason, for reasons of race, other cultural reasons, gender and so forth, look for signs of affirmation. I'm actually real. I do exist. I'm not somebody that is dumb. And that's what the education system decided, that I was, what was the word? Educationally subnormal.
Really, that was a classification.
That was the classification. Yeah. And vividly remember, because there was a neighbour next door, Mandy. And Mandy used to get the bus. And the bus was for the dumb children. It was almost like a system that was exquisitely designed to torture.
Yeah.
Because the bus stopped outside the school gate in full view of all the other children that were not getting on that bus. My parents were called in, and Dad was the one that went in to do the heavy lifting. Dad went head to head with the headmistress, the principals, and Mrs. Barnes said, "Oh, Wilfred has difficulty in reading and writing," and Dad listened to her carefully. In fact, he told me before we went what he was going to do and how he was going to dress and how he referred to himself, because he was very aware of the class system. Mm. So he never wore a tie. He wore a working man's flat cap. And he said, when I get forms from the school and they ask for my occupation, I always put porter. I never put that I have any sort of supervisory or anything that indicates my intelligence. So there were some really harsh, frightening lessons for me.
Well, look, there are so many issues that your book deals with, race and sexual orientation, class, being a migrant in two countries virtually.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the whole tone of it is very gentlemanly. There's no stridency, there's no anger. In fact, the way that you described your father dealing with issues is pretty much the way you unfurl the story. Mm. Did you do that deliberately, or was it just the way that things came out on the page?
That was an accurate reflection of my upbringing. My parents never hid anything. They talked about racism. Dad only told me about what happened when he got his first job, and his brother-in-law had got him this job because that's how things worked in those days. Mm. He said the foreman or whoever the person was in charge handed him a broom. And my mouth dropped open, because I knew my dad had studied law at night school at London University. And I said, "What did you do, Daddy?" He said, "I swept." Mm-hmm. And, I didn't know, think that my mouth could go any further onto the floor. And I said, "You swept?" And he said, "I had a family to feed." So he sacrificed his pride. He didn't forget who he was. He didn't forget where he'd come from. He didn't forget his values. And he actually said, "I find," if he was talking about instances of racism or people showing some dislike of him or shouting or whatever, he said, I found that quite amusing. Mm-hmm. He said, "Because I always turned that to my advantage." And I guess the phrase that comes to mind is, when others go lower, you go higher. And he had very clear principles based on the Bible. He was a man with a vision. And his vision was to go back home. And to go back home, in order to be able to do that, he had to have a foundation. And my mum was then the other part of that foundation, because she was the saver. They both worked very hard, but she was the one that looked after the money. I was the oldest of three boys, and I had to be an example to them to, in a way, absorb a lot of stuff.
Now, writing is a focused long-term plan. You had a full-time job, which in Australia is?
Well, I'm now with Lifeline, but prior to that I was a case manager and I did one or two other things as well.
Yeah, and you've got a very rich cultural life and you write. And writing is a very lonely one with oneself process. And you're a very gregarious person, which is something that, it runs a little bit in contrast to that. So what happened there?
I think there are many, many layers to my personality that I've discovered since I've been in Australia. That's been a revelation. Being in Australia has released something in me. I don't know, self-belief opened a door that was always there in plain sight, but I just chose not to see it.
What was the catalyst?
It was the first writers group that I went to, and you had to read out your work. And I resisted that. I resisted it also in the group that we were part of. And, you know, the convener of that group has many funny stories of me running away. And I literally did run away, and I was wiping my brow thinking, phew, I escaped that again.
That changed, I'll have you know. We were elbowing each other towards the end of who was going to be next.
It did.
I want to home in on what was it about Australian culture that gave you that freedom to explore these other layers that you're talking about?
People would not know or would not necessarily realise how profound the Australian influence is on English culture and the presence of Australians. And then I got to work with Australians in the mid-1990s, and that was a revelation. One was the sort of, I guess you call larrikinism, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm a pretty hard taskmaster when it comes to work. Mm-hmm. And I was used to the 9-to-5ers. I got this bunch of Australian guys and women. They just blew me away with their work ethic, their imagination. And then they say, oh, we're going down to the pub tonight. And then they say, well, what time do you want us in tomorrow morning, boss? And I say, oh, 7:30. Isn't that going to be too early for you if you're going to the pub? He said, no, we'll be here. And they were before me. And I was just astonished. So I think that when I came here, it was like, everything just clicked.
Triggered.
It made sense. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, I've been to many countries. Mm. I like Australians.
Yeah. Period of time that I've listened to you write, I think that your writing has changed, evolved, developed.
Mm.
Do you feel that as well?
Yeah, as I've peeled away those layers of doubt or anger or pain, as well as the triumphs.
And do you enjoy writing, or is it a hard task?
I do now.
Right.
So I write poetry, I perform poetry, spoken word, I've been a producer.
You're not really subnormal in reading and writing, really. Can we put that one to bed? Can we write to this teacher in the UK?
No, I'm not. But to leave that shadow behind, it was almost like trying to outrun a shadow that someone else had cast over me. Yes. It was not who I was. I love word. And my parents were always talking. Always talking. The smallest thing, the largest thing, laughing. Never denigrating people. Never looking at people as less than them.
If somebody was listening to this and wanting to start a writing project and not knowing where to start, especially if it's a memoir like yours is, what advice would you give them?
Trust your process. It could be, I don't know, drawing cartoons, and from that come words, and from that come sentences. It could be looking out of the window and daydreaming, and from that comes a scene in your life and you want to write it down. It could be conversation that you have with a dear friend and you want to capture that, just put it on your phone or write it down on a scrap of paper. Whatever you do, however you do it, the important thing is to start. But funnily enough, I'm also one of the world's greatest prevaricators, because there's always that little voice that says, oh, you're a bit of a fake, really. You're this writing malarkey. Nobody's going to read what you've written.
It's the writer's curse. And I've spoken to people who are published and really well-known who say the same thing.
And you think, oh, I finally found Nirvana. I'm finally into, you know, my groove. And boom.
Yeah.
It makes an appearance and says, no.
So when you hit that, what do you do? What do you suggest that
I might just walk away for a moment. I might recognize it for what it is, accept it for what it is, and say it's a load of rubbish.
Mm.
I can write. Maybe I'll pull out something I've written. Maybe I'll just start scribbling. I love walking. Mm. Walking sort of sorts out the wheat from the chaff, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I come back with a sort of clarity and I start writing.
On that note, I'd like to invite you to read a
book. Okay. I've got two pieces here. The first one is skin protection. I first became aware of my skin colour when I was about 6 years old. I knew my skin had to be protected from the harsh English weather. Rain, hail, sleet, snow, ice. With a product called Vaseline. My body had to be protected at all times, but more so during the winter, with a heavy coat, hat, gloves, which I hated, so I compromised with mittens, which allowed my fingers to poke through, shoes or Wellington boots. Mum and Dad repeated that if I didn't protect my hands and feet, I'd get chilblains. They didn't explain how you got chilblains, but I found out many years later. Your hands or your feet itch and blister because of a temporary loss of blood supply to the extremities of the body. I ignored my parents and never got chilblains until I went to college. I have the scars to prove it. One morning, Mum was getting ready to send me off to school, which was around the corner from where we lived in Kilburn. She checked and rechecked my clothing and whether I had enough Vaseline on my face. I assured her I did, but she took my face in her hand and turned it from side to side. I just hoped the ordeal would be over quickly. Then she gave me my dinner money, and just as I was about to put it in my pocket, she said, "Son?" "Me." "Yes, Mummy." "Mum, you do know you'll always have to work 10 times as hard as your white school friends." "Me." "Yes, Mummy." That was it. Mum never mentioned it again, but I pondered the words she'd used for colour, black and white. I thought about the amount of effort required for me to do something. I thought no further about this, but it wasn't long before the truth of her words became brutally apparent to me. The kiss. Julie looked at me intensely. There was nowhere for me to hide. It was now or never. Julie confidently spoke. "You have to kiss me now. That's the rule." I thought to argue, but age 6, this did not seem possible against the determined passion of a 6-year-old girl. I prepared myself to kiss her. The kiss had come about because Julie dared me to do it. Julie was a friend, and we went to the same primary school, St. John's. She lived locally, and her mum was friendly with my mum. Julie always seemed keen to touch my skin, which wasn't white like hers. I tried to show her that her touching left me uncomfortable. I'd move away from her, but she'd just follow anyway. Julie began to suggest we play her version of kiss and chase, where one child hides and the other has to shut their eyes and then look for the hidden child. If they fail to find them, the loser gets to kiss the winner. One school day afternoon, she said, we should play kiss chase. I demurred. We'll get into trouble. But she insisted. I followed her slowly while looking around for teachers and other children, hoping that we'd be stopped or questioned. Julie found an empty classroom, full of grey metal chairs, tables and wooden cupboards. Now I understood there was no escape, but hoped that a teacher would walk in and scupper Julie's plan. No teacher or other child appeared. Julie said, "I'm going to hide and you need to count to 10, but shut your eyes." I said, "Okay," crawling under a nearby table, which would take my sizable frame. I was nervous, but hoping to get this over and done with. I stayed where I was. I counted softly to myself. 1, 2, 3, up to 10, and then opened my eyes from under the table. I looked around. There was a closed door leading out to the classroom, to another classroom. I wanted this game to be over and the quickest way to let Julie have her one kiss and be done. I stayed put and she joined me under the table. She placed her face close to mine and said, "You have to kiss me." I said nothing, closed my eyes, pursed my lips as I'd seen them do in the films, and moved my mouth closer to hers. Then in a second it was done. I had kissed her, but in that moment a thought came to me. I don't like kissing girls, I like boys. That was it. That's when I first knew I liked boys. I told no one. It took me another 14 years to act on that thought.
Fabulous. Thank you, Will.
Pleasure.
Well, that was Will Roach reading from his creative memoir. And now in the studio, I have Kelly Edwards, who is going to be helping me critique Will's work. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks, Maria.
Tell me a little bit about your background. I mean, I know what it is. It's amazing. So just for the benefit of our listeners.
Oh, it's a bit like Will, really. I've done lots of things in my life. Then I went off to do law, and so now I'm a barrister in the human rights space. So I'm very interested in what he had to say about what it does to you to live outside of the dominant cultural constructed regime.
Interesting to listen to Will unfold his experience of discrimination in such a gentle way. I apologise for having to use the word gentlemanly all the time, but it was the only way I could describe it.
Well, the lack of anger and rage is very interesting.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the first things that people on the margins are taught to swallow. Get angry. They're often painted as crazy or subnormal in some way. But as he said about his own IQ test, and what we know about the IQ tests of the 60s, of course, were that they were incredibly culturally encoded.
It still haunts me that when he was describing his dad, armed with his law degree, going into a firm and being given a broom, he said, "What did you do, Daddy?" He said, "I swept." Wow. It's,
yeah, extraordinary resilience.
Yes. I think Australians have got a different attitude towards racism than that highly structured English system. Is that something you agree with?
I think there is no surprise that he was so freed by the Australian culture to be able to write in a more free way.
Yeah.
And that's because Australians are like other people of difference. We were convicts, immigrants, Indigenous folk who were rejected by England.
I also know that you're a writer, Kelly, and you write beautifully. So I want to home in on the actual writing itself. The two pieces that he wrote about were about colour and were about his sexual orientation. Very big topics. And yet his is such an elegant way, and using little common, intimate, personal, day-to-day examples, kissing a girl for the first time or somebody touching his skin. What are your thoughts on that?
His language is beautiful. It's so simple.
Yeah.
And thank God for that, because the issues that he is traversing are so very complex.
Yes.
What he's really writing about is, again, not wanting his skin to be an issue. You know, he doesn't want her fascination with him to be a factor of something over which he has no control, and in fact is the reason why he has to work 10 times harder and that kind of thing. And I just thought it was so deft the way he dealt with, you know, not only was he running away from the racial issues and the cultural issues, he couldn't, and she had power over him, even though she was a woman. You know, it's that interesting intersectionality point about the fact that a white woman trumps the black guy. And then mixed into all of that is his feeling of sexual difference and identification at such an early age, which put him even more on the outers. And again, he couldn't talk about that. So he writes incredibly beautifully and expressively about not being able to talk about those key things at all at those times.
Yeah. I think the magic of it, he is Will. This is the person who is writing, and all these other factors are just elements of who he is. What's deceptive is that to be able to maintain and sustain and build that sense of confidence is a huge task.
Yes, yes. But it's a confidence that doesn't allow him to call himself a writer. And he used the word, I was violently against that.
Yes.
And I think that does spring from this, when you are on the outside, you're not authorised to give yourself those kinds of culturally forbidden roles. Ooh, you know, a writer is a writer who's part of the canon. You'll never be part of the canon if you've never heard those voices before. And he talks about never hearing anyone or seeing anyone like him at the time. And that was very true in that period. You know, it's only later we've had the Zadie Smiths of the world. But I think there's a freedom in not being defined by roles as well. You do not tie me down to my skin, to my role as a writer, to anything. I will be whatever I want to be. Inspiring.
It is inspiring. It is, it's what I'm finding is a theme with all the writers I've dealt with so far, who are sort of on the margins of mainstream. The beautiful slices of insights that they get into life.
All writers are outsiders, really. I mean, there's lots been written about
true.
This. But it's much easier to be, you know, a Shelley than it is to be a Will.
Yes.
I did think it was interesting how all writers are liars, aren't they? That he said he had such a good memory about his childhood, because I just don't believe that.
Oh, Look, I agree with you in principle, but you weren't there when Will was first exercising his writing muscle in our writers' groups a couple of years ago. And Will's work was enormously detailed right in the very beginning. He was imagining every moment, every second.
Well, this is my point.
Yeah?
What you're doing is imagining it.
Ah! Oh, I'm beginning to doubt myself, Kelly.
You're reimagining it. I think what writers are good at is holding that feeling of what that was like at that time and then re-describing it, reimagining it.
Well, what I found good about Will's writing is that Will has developed a style that is so fluid that it's seamless. What about you?
So it's like a lens in which he's pulling in close and being present. Yes. Immediately, then somehow pulling back.
Oh, I knew you'd make that make sense.
And it's a visual thing, isn't it? I also thought the way he described things was very visually rich.
Yes.
You could see very easily how to turn it into a movie or...
It's one of those books that I think I do enjoy just reading because there's so much internal stuff that's happening.
And what I found interesting about the whole introduction was all of those themes were actually in the pieces that he wrote.
Yeah.
I think I loved... what he said about his father, he was a silent, dominant influence. And how he didn't really find out about his father's story until in his 20s, and he was really frightened of him but didn't understand him. That's the interesting task of the memoir, and because it's the lacuna in which the writer doesn't understand something.
Yeah.
And so you go back and you try and reconstruct what happened around that time and who that person was and how they behaved to understand that thing that is missing from your ability to come to grips with who they are and why they were the way they were, why they were able to be such a gentleman and suck it up when he had a law degree and was asked to sweep the floor.
Memoir is now so popular. People love reading memoirs. Why do you think that is?
Well, I've got an 11-year-old daughter who's completely obsessed by 60s and 70s rock stars.
Yeah.
So she loves the Beatles and Elton John. And despite reading to her every evening of her life until she was about 6 or 7 when she didn't want it anymore, and she's now obsessed by memoirs. What it offers to you is an opportunity to understand the choices another person makes, I think. And, you know, Will's really trying to understand the choices that his father made. Memoirs, very interesting for getting inside the heads of someone else's lived experience. I wasn't in those writers' groups with William. I wish I was, because he's got some amazing things to say, and his ability to be able to really describe that so well makes it possible for everyone to understand what it was like for him, which is, you know, the alchemy of writing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think for me a memoir is good if it puts me in somebody else's shoes, if it gives me chills, if it evokes feelings, almost like it provides me with memories that I've never had.
Well, you know, you and I have both done lots of research in the area of, what do they call it these days, equality and diversity.
Yeah.
There's a lot of academic terms, but by reading someone like Will, you are getting what it intersectionality is all about.
Yes.
Which is a stunning thing to be able to do in a way that is entertaining.
And it's complex, and it's also it's a beautiful flowering episodes that are full of different elements that make up the whole of life.
Yeah, I mean, those two sections that he read out were just beautiful.
Yeah.
They're simply expressed, but the complexity of layers and issues discussed is amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Kelly Edwards critiquing Will Roach's memoir, Black, Gay and Underage. You can find details of where to access Will's book and his other creative works on our website. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support and inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. New Voices is broadcast on alternate Mondays at 5:30 p.m. and the following Sundays at 1:30 p.m. I look forward to your company at those times.